In a world where nothing ever changes, one man, one microphone, one desire. If you want to hear the best movie reviews, interviews, and news, tune into the Film Hour with Jim Schembri on NTS. Based on a true story.
Hi there, and welcome to the Film Hour, the new, improved, totally refreshed and rebooted high-octane Film Hour that will inform, enlighten and entertain you about what is happening on screens, both large and small. Now, riding along with me this week in the show's jump seat is Sir Dan Mott, film lover, dedicated gamer and panel operator extraordinaire. Say hello, Dan.
Hello, Dan.
Ah, beautifully done. Now, this week, we're going to have a look at the latest new release movies. We'll also take a look at some of the latest worthwhile offerings that are streaming right now on smart TV, tablet, phone, and PC near you. In the interview room, Dan, this week, we're going to talk to director Garth Davis about his beautiful new film, Lion. Our special viewfinder segment, we'll look at some of the great ghost movies of all time. Ooh, ghost movies. And, of course, we'll pluck through the great gems of all the week's thunderously important movie news.
What is angels? Angels just like them.
And Lion is the big Australian film opening this week. Dan, we always look at the beginning of every new year for a really beautiful, strong, audience-friendly Australian film to kick off the year in the hopes that it will be a sort of omen, a sort of a beacon for other good films to open up and give us a really strong year in local cinema. It happened in 2015 with The Water Diviner, which really set the tone. Didn't quite happen last year. Hopefully this year, Lion will set the bar nice and high. It's a very, very well-directed film by Garth Davis, who we'll be hearing from a little later on. It's based on a true story about an Indian gentleman called Saru Brierley, who, as a child, got separated from his brother while they were looking for coal. They scavenged for coal to then resell. They get lost at a train station, and he goes to sleep in a train carriage, wakes up the next day, the sun screaming in his face, the train hurtling along very, very fast away from his home. The kid is completely lost, gets off at Calcutta, and through sheer good luck, ends up in the kind hands of people who pass him on to an adoption agency. Ends up, long story short, in Tasmania. Mother and father, played by Nicole Kidman and David Wenham, is living a very perfectly comfortable, happy life. White, middle class life, privileged, educated, lots of money, lots of friends. Successful girlfriend played by Rooney Mara. Then one day he happens upon a bit of food, some sweet bread that reminds him of his childhood. This triggers off a bunch of memories about his mother and his family, and his conscience begins swelling, and he becomes increasingly worried about how they have been coping all this time while he's been living in some degree of denial in Australia. So how does he find out where he came from? The film is set in the first decade of this century. Someone tells him about this wonderful new thing on the internet called Google Earth. So just using a bit of deduction, I actually use Google Earth to help locate the approximate location where he got off on the train and where his parents might actually be living now. So this is one of the few films, they're going to say, that actually uses the internet in an interesting way. Filmmakers have been struggling with ways to represent the internet in a graphically intriguing way. And I've got to say, Garth Davis, who hates the use of technology in films, has done a really good job by making it just part of the plot and not getting sidetracked. He's also very clever in not getting sidetracked into turning the film into a melodrama. It remains a very restrained, austere, stately drama that really sells its points about loss and family and extended families very, very well. So that's Lion, a beautiful Australian film, strongly recommended. The Return of Xander Cage, XXX, Are you excited, Dan, by the return of Xander Cage?
Not really.
Oh, that's a fair enough comment. This is, of course, Vin Diesel returning to the role that he certainly made a big hit with the first film. Second one came out in 2005 without Vin Diesel, but with Ice Cube. That didn't quite work. He has now returned to presumably revive yet another franchise. He did it with Riddick and he did it with Fast and Furious. And this, I got to say, is just a flat-out entertaining action film. Deliriously preposterous action sequences, very, very well staged. Motorcycles riding across the water, people having fights in zero gravity as cargo planes plummet towards the earth. A lot of gunfights, very, very good film, very, very well staged. Nice to see women in the middle of all the action. This is not a remarkable thing anymore, but Ruby Rose, an Australian actress who's become very famous because of her role in Orange is the New Black, does a very, very good job as a lesbian hit person. I was going to say hit man, but she's a hit person in this. Very, very good film. Very entertaining. Just quickly, Jackie's new biopic about Jackie, the wife of JFK. Natalie Portman does a pretty good job impersonating Jackie Buvway in the days after the assassination of John F. Kennedy in 1963. Very, very good performance. The film overall is a bit, you know, dramatically a little bit inert, but she certainly sells the role. And just take a listen about how good her performance is. Take a listen to this.
Mr. Valenti, would you mind getting a message to all our funeral guests when they land?
Of course.
Inform them that I will walk with Jack tomorrow, alone if necessary. And tell General de Gaulle that if he wishes to ride in an armored car or in a tank for that matter, I won't blame him. And I'm sure the tens of millions of people watching won't either.
Very, very good performance there by Natalie Portman. And quickly, Collateral Beauty is very, very nice. Little fable about a guy, Will Smith, who is visited by the ghosts of time, death, and love to help improve his life. This is the film that's giving us our theme today about ghost movies, but this film has been hated on by absolutely everybody on earth. I can't connect the reviews I've read with the film that I saw. So I actually like this movie for what it was, just a simple, harmless fable about the values in life and how to, you know, value the people close to you. And I thought this was a nice little movie. Will Smith, Helen Mirren, Keira Knightley, Edward Norton, Kate Winslet, Michael Pena. Very, very strong cast. And directed by David Frankel, who gave us Marley and Me, and Devil Wears Prada. So very, very strong credentials there. So I, against the world's opinion, I recommend it. You're listening to The Film Hour with Jim Shembri on NTS.
How about a Cadillac? I get your brand new Cadillac with the pink slip for $2,000.
I still reckon that's a good deal, Dan. I reckon we should. Would you come in with me with that, with the Cadillac? That's a good deal.
Yeah, I'd come
that's
in.
That's a good deal. I mean, I can't drive, so you'll have to chauffeur me everywhere. But yeah, we can help make up the payments by using it as an Uber. We can Uber it. You know, it's a good idea. I think we're in business. Sarah Hyland, you might not recognize the name immediately, but she plays one of the daughters on Modern Family. And it's very interesting to see, you know, these young actors sometimes, they really want to prove that they can do more than what they're best known for. And I was having a look at the vending machine at the train station, as I often do, to pick out the latest films to review on DVD and streaming. And there's this film called See You in Valhalla. And there's a big picture of her. And I thought, oh, yeah, okay. So she's, during her hiatus, she's made a movie. But then I saw that it was rated MA for drug use and frequent coarse language. And then I also saw that she was one of the producers of the film. So I thought, that's enough enticement to check it out. That and the fact that it's 75 minutes long. So even if it was a bad film, it wasn't going to waste a lot of my time. I was actually surprised at how good a job she's done in this film. It's basically about the daughter in a wildly dysfunctional family who returns home upon news that her brother has died. And she is a girl with more problems than you can imagine regarding relationships and children. Her family is completely disconnected from each other. Every member seems to hate every other member of the family. The father is an absolute disaster, and they just basically try to use the impending funeral of this lost member of the family as a means to get some sort of cohesion back into their lives, which they struggle to do. There's a few comic elements in it, but it's mainly a dramatic film. Sarah Hyland, if she's using this film as a excuse or as a vehicle to showcase her abilities to act beyond her Modern Family range, does a very, very good job in this film. So I'd actually recommend this film as a pretty good time killer. So not a bad film. Pierce Brosnan also producing his own stuff these days. Not really worrying too much about the legacy of Bond, given how much he trashes it. He's put together a film called IT, which is a pretty standard cyber thriller about he runs an aviation company that's trying to adopt the Uber model. Or the problem is he's overextended himself. So he's desperate to put the company up for public a public offering. So it'll become a public company. Unfortunately, there's a psycho working in his company in the IT department who has cracked all the codes and basically does the usual job of a psycho stalker and tries to sort of ruin the company. He, of course, then hires someone to help get the information he needs so he can bypass all the damage that's being done to his company. It's not a very well-plotted film, given that it was directed by John Moore, who did the last Die Hard film. Surprisingly clumsy direction. So, you know, interesting to see Pierce Brosnan, you know, pushing his Irish accent a bit more than he usually does. Not a bad time killer, this film, but unfortunately nothing exceptional and a bit of a letdown plot-wise. Both those films are available on iTunes and Google Play, as well as DVD, of course. But the big one that I had fun with this week, Dan, Westworld. Dan, are you familiar with the 1973 movie by Michael Crichton at all?
Not at all.
Not at all? You haven't heard of it?
Haven't heard of it.
No, but I bet you you've seen the episode of The Simpsons where they visit a amusement park and all the robots start malfunctioning and go crazy and start attacking the family.
Unfortunately, I'm one of those people who never watched The Simpsons.
That's fair enough. But you are, Dan, of the generation that tends to see the parody before seeing the original. That's the way I like to phrase it. Certainly The Simpsons has done a lot to borrow from many films, including Westworld. Westworld in 1973, classic film, basically about parks that replicate different periods in history, and they're all populated by robots. And what you do is that you go in there and you can play a character in whatever world you want, and you can do whatever you like, and there are no consequences because you're not doing anything illegal because they're all robots. And Westworld is the most popular of these worlds. Now, and of course what happens is the robots, and the main robot in the film was played by Yul Brynner, they start to malfunction, go crazy, just to teach us a lesson, Dan, to teach us a lesson about the dangers of putting too much faith in technology. And that if we give them too much power, eventually they will turn on us. This is an age-old theme that will never, ever get tired because it's so relevant and because it's potentially so true. We've got to watch how much we invest in technology. That was the classic 1973 film. With this TV update, I'm absolutely knocked out. When I saw the logo for the show, I thought, how on earth are they going to adapt that old movie to a 10-part TV series? Are you kidding? And what they've done is what they should always do when they reboot something. We were in this era where everything's remade and rebooted and rethought and re-engineered. What you got to do, as they did with the Planet of the Apes films, is you've got to go back to the original concept, preserve the bare bones of that concept, and then rethink everything from the ground up. So what you've got here is essentially a beautiful collision of genres, where you've got the Western genre and you've got the sci-fi genre. So you've basically got clones in a Western setting, and you've got a constant shifting between the Western world, where all these robots are following pre-programmed narratives, and the command center, which is, of course, in stark contrast, is all sleek and modern and full of 3D printers that create horses and creatures for the Westworld setting. I was absolutely knocked out by this film. It was co-created by Lisa Joy, who did Bird Notice, and Jonathan Nolan, who is the brother and collaborator of Christopher Nolan. I strongly recommend Westworld. The first two episodes knocked me out. It's available on iTunes, Dendy Direct, Google Play, and PlayStation. You're listening to The Film Hour with Jim Shembri on NTS.
I'm starting to remember a life I'd forgotten.
Are you okay?
I had another family, a mother, a brother. I can still see their faces.
What happened?
I have to find my way back home.
Yes, this week our very special guest in the interview room is Garth Davis, the director of Lion, a moving drama that tells the true story of Saru Briley, an Indian man adopted to Australian parents as a boy after getting lost in Calcutta. Now, we had a really good discussion with Garth, the extended version of which is available online at 3aw.com.au, and I began our discussion by asking Davis, given the number of times he has to see the film during production, at what point he realized that the film, which is being hailed across the world, was working.
Through the process, I experienced it definitely. And even now when I sit and watch the movie, it touches me in so many different ways and at different times. Like, I watched the film yesterday in Melbourne, and the whole brother thing really got me. The whole Gudu thing really got me on that viewing. But every viewing's different.
and I'm interested to know the position you're in right now, where the film is kind of being released. You're getting a lot of accolades for it and a lot of praise. Garth, does this make you feel more confident or more nervous?
I'm a pretty on the ground kind of person, so I feel I just feel really relieved that it works. You know, when you're making a movie, you've just got to trust your instincts and surround yourself in the best by the best people, the most passionate and kind of tonally aligned people. And you've just got to really trust that all the way. And I think that's the secret to making a good film.
Because
I get nervous when that's not working.
Because just to make the point that there is nothing wrong with melodrama, I guess one of the ways that you could have gone with this film is to really push the melodramatic elements, which you have not done with this movie. Can you just tell me about, you know, how hard it was to maintain a balance between the very powerful emotions that run under this story and keeping it from going over a certain line where it feels like you're pushing the sentimentality too much?
Yeah, it's a good question. It was a fine line because, I like emotion in movies. I think it's something that's not used enough. But the only way it works, I think, is you've got to find the truth behind it, and it's got to be complicated. So the emotion's got to come from a lot of different things. So I had to just do a lot of work with the characters and just go very deep and try to find complicated reasons to their emotion. And luckily with this story, there was so many real-life people to talk to and work with and be inspired by. So for me, the emotion in this movie comes very naturally because of the truth of it. You know, we're not afraid to go into dark places. We're not afraid to sour something that's going very beautifully either. And I think audiences appreciate that.
One of the really skillful things I found about the film was that it does have the feel of almost epic simplicity to the story. At the same time, you are allowing space in the performances for people to have conversations with each of the characters. It's a beautifully sort of internalized performances that connect directly with the audience. I mean, you get a backstory almost intuitively with the mother, with the father, with the main characters, of course, but everyone sort of emotionally gets their day in court with the audience. Can you just tell me about that approach?
No, you're absolutely right, and I'm so happy that you see that, because that was the intention. Well, you know, I think the danger of this story is just telling the A story, you know, because then you might as well just read an article about it. So for me, it was like, how do we make a film that has complexity and all that? But one of the things that I realised is that all of the characters in this movie are yearning, or you know, or had some sort of loss. Even Lucy lost her mother. You know, obviously, all the characters are kind of looking to fill that hole in some way. So I really wanted to respect that with the characters. But the other thing too is that I found that they were, especially Sue, Kamala, and Saru, they're all just so spiritually connected. You know, like in that great scene in the film where Sue talks about the vision and how almost the adoption is like this predetermined or a sense of destiny, and how Saru talks about, you know, in his dreams, he kind of goes home to India every night and whispers in his mother's ear, he's okay, he's alive. And Kamala feeling, you know, kind of knowing that he was alive, and that's why she never left the village. So I felt like they were all connected in this amazing way, and I just wanted to feel that under the scenes.
Now, it was while you were making Top of the Lake that your producers read the story of Saru in Vanity Fair and apparently said, hey, this story is so Garth. What does so Garth mean? What did they mean when they said that?
Well, probably a really complicated shoot would be the first thing.
I'm giving you permission to be a bit kinder to yourself.
Yeah, so, yeah, they thought, oh, this is a really complicated thing to shoot, so that's very Garth. And probably that there was the emotionality of it, probably. You know, there's a lot of emotion in my work, so they, I don't know, maybe you have to ask them the question, but sure. I think that would be what it is.
I think the timing that this film is coming out at the moment is rather auspicious. With all the debating that's going on at the moment about what it means to be Australian, about other cultures living within what is called an Australian culture. Is this film intended to impart any sort of message? Do you want people to take away a certain reading from the film?
Look, that was never my intention. But what's been really curious is in the making of the film, it's broadened the conversation into all of these areas, and which I think is really interesting. I mean, for me, what this story does is it just goes back to basics, you know, that through love, we can do anything we want, you know, and you can, and it's not about where you come from, what colour your skin is, whether you're an adoptive child or a birth child. It's like love can solve all those problems. And I just think that through this story, you know, it kind of connects with a lot of these kind of conversations that are going on. And I feel like hopefully it just maybe recenters people's thinking and they're not so quick to judge.
Certainly, I think the theme that really resonates is the concept of family, that at the end of the day, it is love. It's nothing to do with blood, with race, with That's politics, exactly. with nationality.
Yeah, I mean, home is not, you know, the house with the garage and the car. It's where you're loved, you know.
Now, you work very, very closely with Saru Brierley and with the families involved in the stories from the outset of the making of this film. Now, Garth, some great American film directors, such as Sidney Lumet, argue against that approach, that you use the factual basis for your story for the research that you need, then you just go away and you make the film. What was so important about working so closely with the families, and what difference do you think that made to the film?
Well, they're my teachers in many ways, and to be honest, they're such inspiring people and such magical people. I just wanted to understand them and be with them as much as possible. And so for me, it was an enormous source of inspiration. I suppose I just had to find a way to kind of connect all that visually and exude that in the story. But, I mean, I could not have done it without, to this level, without meeting them. How could I? It just would have been my story, not their story.
Now, of all the awards that you're likely to get for this film, I'd like to give you a special award, and that is the award for the best use of the internet in a plot. Because, mate, I don't have to tell you, filmmakers have been struggling now for about 10 years to make the internet visually interesting and part of a plot. They've just bent over backwards trying to make it this new whiz-bang thing. You handled it so beautifully because you didn't make a big deal about it. You didn't overdo the graphics. You just said, well, there's this thing called Google Earth, and this is how it works, and this is how it can help you in your search.
Oh, thank you. I can't stand technology in movies. So in this one, it was pretty hard to avoid because this is how we found home. So it was a huge thorn in my side as a director. But you know what? One of the things that I thought of was actually Peter Weir, who I just adore, and Picnic at Hanging Rock. I thought, well, if Peter can make that rock powerful, then I can make Google powerful.
Now, let's take a look through the viewfinder.
I think that's quite enough of that, Dan, in case you didn't find the reboot of the Ghostbusters movie with all female cast irritating enough. I thought I'd play that. That's the Chimpunks version of the Ghostbusters theme. Did you ever get around to seeing
Ghostbusters? No, I was going to, and then I thought I just sort of just stop thinking about it, you know?
Yeah.
So I might actually check it out on Blu-ray or something down the track.
It'll be coming out. I tell you what, it'll be coming out fairly soon. Mm. If it's not out already, I mean, you know what? I got a feeling it's out already.
It should be out.
And I should check it out because I wanted to see what they do with the 3D sequences in the film because it was shot in 3D. What the director, Paul Feig, did, which shows you just how bad 3D is getting, is that, you know how the proverbial intended effect of 3D is to make you feel like the thing is coming out of the screen. Mm. Well, in some sequences, you know, where they're shooting the beams out of their Ghostbusters packs and you've got these ray beams coming out, well, he would actually shorten, he'd resize the frame so that it's actually not as wide as it should be. And actually have the beam coming out of the frame line of the film to actually fake the impression that it's coming out of the screen. And to actually see a fake 3D effect in 3D is, I will say, a new low watermark in just how poor 3D has become. But I've gotten off the subject. I'm sorry about that. We'll have a look at 3D and in Ghostbusters probably in a couple of weeks' time. In the meantime, though, I thought it'd be fun to have a look at ghost movies, given that Collateral Beauty kind of deals with the idea of ghosts and spirits in the world that come visit us. And also because I did review it last week, Middle School, you know, very funny teen comedy about the hassles of going to school and dealing with a really strict principal. That also has as unlikely as it says, it has a ghost theme in it. Very, very well done it is too. So I thought, let's have a look at some ghost movies. Now, you probably have never heard of Blythe Spirit, but Blythe Spirit was one of the first big ghost films ever made. It was directed by David Lean, who did Bridge on the River Kwai, Ryan's Daughter, Lawrence of Arabia. One of his first films back in 1946, first big films, was Blythe Spirit, which was written for the stage by Noel Coward and produced as a film with David Lean. Now, Noel Coward, very, very famous playwright, Dan, was not very happy with David Lean's cutting of the play, because he said, listen, people love the play, just shoot the play. Apparently David Lean came back and said, people do not want to watch a 2.5-hour movie about something as frivolous as the idea of the ghost of a wife coming back to haunt her ex-husband and his new wife, which is what the film is about. And he said, you have to make it a movie. And so he cut it, and he actually shot a film, and there were some interesting special effects in that film. But let's take a quick listen to some wonderful dialogue from Blythe Spirit.
What's the matter?
Matter?
Yes, you seem odd somehow. Do you feel quite well?
Fine. I think I'll have a drink. Do you want one?
No, thank you, dear.
It's getting very chilly. Oh, my...
Charles, that was very clumsy, Charles, dear.
Oh, Vera, then it's true. It was you.
Of course it was. Charles, darling, Charles, what are you talking about?
Are you a ghost?
I suppose I must be. It's all very confusing. What do you keep looking over there for? Look at me. What's happened?
Don't you see?
See what?
Elvira.
Elvira?
Yes. Elvira, dear, this is Ruth. Ruth, this is Elvira.
Come and sit down, darling.
What do you mean to say you can't see her?
Look, Charles, you just sit down quietly by the fire and I'll fix you another drink. Don't worry about the mess on the carpet. Edith can clean that up in the morning.
But you must be able to see her. She's here. Look, right in front of you, here.
Lovely little interplay there. The dialogue not quite as quick as it is in the film. I had to cut out some of the pauses, otherwise we would have been here for another 2 minutes. But that really sort of shows down the little trick that, or the little challenge for actors who are in films like this to try to pretend that there's not another person in the room. One person can see the ghost, the other person can't see the ghost. That's a little hurdle that they've got to get over. They do it very well in Blythe Spirit, as they did in the film Always, where the ghost of a pilot comes back to visit Holly Hunter. I don't know if you've heard it. It's a remake. It's a Steven Spielberg film called Always, remake of a film called My Name Is Joe, about firefighters who are fighting these huge forest fires in America. With Richard Dreyfuss, John Goodman, the plane goes down, he dies, but he's able to come back and visit her. And it's a very underrated Steven Spielberg film, one of the best films about ghosts that I've seen. And again, this whole idea really is using the ghost device as a means of saying, Dan, that what ghosts actually are the power of memory of a person to simply refuse to leave you. If you love somebody intensely and they're suddenly out of your life, your mind is so geared and so polarized to see that person everywhere that you will actually see patterns. Your mind, without you doing anything conscious, your mind will automatically form patterns in popcorn that you've dropped on the floor, or in, you know, a random static you might see in objects. You will see that person's face, and every cue, every visual cue, every odor that you might associate with the person, if you had liked having certain coffee together, every time you smell something, it'll remind you of them. This is where really the concept of ghosts come from, and films really sort of use that idea of the emotional memory of someone to use the ghost device. Dan, do you believe in ghosts?
I don't, Jim.
No?
Nope.
Now, what about in terms of the concept that I just described there, the idea of the person might not physically be here, but because you love them or like them so much that you kind of see them in objects, or you're constantly reminded of them so much that you feel their presence.
Yeah, I can agree with that concept. Yeah,
because people often say, you know, I was working in the garden, you know, which I used to do with my ex-husband for 40 years. He died last year, and now we're I'm in the garden. I felt his presence with me. So you know, ghost films, we love them. There's been a zillion of them. Some of them have been scary, like the Nightmare on Elm Street films. But what I liked is comedies have often had fun with ghost films. Probably not as much as we'd like. We mentioned Ghostbusters before. One of my very, very favorite comedies using ghost, or the idea of an imagined person, which is essentially the same thing, was an old Woody Allen film called Play It Again, Sam, which was directed by Herbert Ross. It was one of Woody Allen's first movies. It was based on a play that he'd written, and it's about a nerdish film critic who is obsessed with Humphrey Bogart, and he has Humphrey Bogart basically in his life trying to give him advice about how to get women. And here's an example of Woody Allen talking to Humphrey Bogart during an emotional romantic scene.
You're handling yourself very well. Now kiss her.
Please.
You built up to it beautifully.
I don't have the nerve.
Look, tell her how beautiful she is again.
I just told her.
Again.
You really are an unusually beautiful person.
Oh, I don't know what to say.
No, really, Ren, you are exceptionally beautiful. You're a very beautiful girl. You are very uncommonly beautiful. You're an unusually beautiful
woman. All right, already.
It's been so long since anybody said that to me.
Now move closer to her.
How close?
The length of your lips.
It's very close.
Come on, move.
The length of your lips. It's lovely stuff. That's Woody Allen. One other quick bit of audio I'd like to play you is from Truly Madly Deeply, which is probably one of the most beautiful dramatic films about a ghost. Juliette Stevenson plays a woman who loses the love of her life, played by Alan Rickman, in probably his best dramatic performance. Take a listen to this.
I love you.
I love you.
I really love you.
Really, truly love you.
I really, truly, madly love you.
Really, truly, madly, deeply love you.
I really, truly, madly, deeply, passionately love you.
Really, truly, madly, deeply, passionately, remarkably love you.
I really, truly, madly, deeply, passionately, remarkably. Deliciously love you.
Really, truly, madly, passionately, remarkably, deliciously, juicily love you.
Deeply. Deeply! You passed on deeply, which was your word, which means that you couldn't have meant it. So you're a fraud, actually. You're probably a figment of my imagination.
It starts off with this very high-tech syntho-sequency type thing, like this.
On NTS Movie News, the weekly wrap-up of all the things you need to know about, and some things you probably don't.
Big finish! Ba-ba-da-da.
I got chills.
Oh, I got chills as well. Now, Dan, we saw this coming. It happens almost every time there's a film that comes out that deals with mental illness. Now, we have to acknowledge that, you know, there are some very sensitive subjects out there that filmmakers should rightly be sensitive about dealing with, so that they don't portray something that's false or portray something that's misleading or that's really hurtful. Having said that, there are limits to the amount of demands that you can make on filmmakers in terms of what they do in films, because after all, it's made up, it's fiction. Now, next week, we've got the release of what I think is a really good movie from M. Night Shyamalan called Split. We will review it properly next week, but just in brief, the film involves a character with about 23 different personalities, played by James McAvoy. And it's a kidnap drama. He kidnaps three girls, and they find that when they talk to this guy, they're dealing with different personalities who have different agendas and different ways of dealing with the other personalities inside this guy. I thought it was a very, very good film. However, the people from Sane Australia, which overlooks the portrayal of mental illness in film and TV, have, as they have before, come out and absolutely lacerated the film for its portrayal of multiple personality disorder. Yes, Dan?
Well, I'm sure they would be going over the top in that movie on purpose, just to, you know, scare the crap out of people.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. And here's the thing. They have come out and they have just absolutely, the CEO of Sane Australia has just gone nuts over how horrified he is about this film and how inaccurate it is and how it's going to give people the wrong impression. We have to remember that the vast majority of people who go to see films are sensible people who know the difference between reality of their lives and the fantasy they see in films. And they know that when they're seeing a film, they're seeing something that's made up, that has dramatic license applied, that is exaggerated, that is contorted, that is caricatured. If you want to know about mental illness, Dan, if you are interested in multiple personality disorder and wanted facts about it, you would not go to a movie for your reference. Just as if you were interested in paleontology, You wouldn't go to Jurassic World. You would actually consult a documentary or a reference book. People do not consider fiction films, fiction feature films, as reliable, fact-based reference points for subjects. If they are serious about knowing something, they will go to proper references. And we really, it's 2016, we really should be, I think, a bit mature about these kinds of things and mature enough to know that we can't hold filmmakers responsible for portraying with absolute balance and absolute accuracy any kind of medical condition that they portray in a film. They have to do things for dramatic purposes. That's what M. Night Shyamalan has done in this film. And I reckon we should just acknowledge that it is a fiction movie. It's not to be relied on for facts about mental illness. That's my little editorial. Let's move on to some fun news about casting. Anna Kendrick from Pitch Perfect and Up in the Air, really good up-and-coming actress, is going to play the daughter of Santa Claus in a film called Nicole that's coming up in a short while from rom-com expert Mark Lawrence, who gave us Miss Congeniality and The Rewrite with Hugh Grant. He's come up with an idea based on the story of the daughter of Santa Claus, who apparently, Dan, did you know that Santa Claus had a daughter?
No.
Apparently she's been around in Santa Claus folklore for about a century, so she hasn't been made up for this movie. She's actually been around. And so what Mark Lawrence has done is he thought, well, let's see if we can get a film out of it. He's come up with a movie called Nicole, in which Anna Kendrick will play the daughter who takes over the family business when Dad decides to retire. In other casting news, we've got, I don't know where we're going with this, Will Smith, who cannot buy a hit at the moment. Concussion, Focus, Collateral Beauty, unfortunately, was a failure, as was Beyond Earth, or After Earth, his big science fiction film with his son. The guy's basically having trouble with his career. He apparently is hot, however, to play a lead role in the live-action version of Dumbo by Tim Burton. Now, Dan, purists will note that Dumbo was basically about the elephant with the bigger ears, okay? And it was a very elephant-centric story. Once you cast a major A-list actor, as Will Smith still is, how is that going to affect the story? Is the story going to be more about him and his family or about the elephant? Purists will want to see the elephant story, I think, rather than the Will Smith story. So that is one piece of casting that sort of got me a bit kind of tentative about whether or not that is going to work. Now, a recent study from a respected body in the United States has shown that the number of female directors behind major Hollywood films is down to 7%. That was in 2016. They did a survey of the top 250 movies and found 7% had women behind them. I mean, one of them was the Jodie Foster film Money Monster. That was one of the very few films, though, made by women. Now, this is an ongoing problem. Women simply don't get behind films that make huge amounts of money. I think it's as simple as that. If you want women to up those figures, they got to get behind films like Triple X. But boy directors tend to make boy movies, and that is one of the hard realities. It's slowly changing, but it's going to take a while. You're listening to The Film Hour with Jim Shembri on NTS.
Is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friends.
Ah, yes, Dan. You got anything big planned for the next week, Dan? Anything big going on? Anything big on the viewing horizon?
I still need to see Passengers.
I'm very keen to hear. You know that film it's gone nuts at the box office. I mean, forget what critics have said, forget what I've said. That film has made like $12 million in 3 weeks.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, the lead actors, like Chris Pratt.
There's no story. I mean, you're watching. You go, well, what's this? No, two people on a giant ship, stuck on a giant ship, and what's happening? This plot-wise, there's nothing happening. In terms of plot, the film doesn't have a plot. People are flocking to this film, and it's doing huge business. It's number four at the box office at the moment, so all power to Passengers. And if you see it, I'd like your review, and we can deconstruct.
I'll let you know my thoughts.
Well, I'd like to deconstruct the concept of the film about a ship on a 120-year journey through space. We're going to leave you this week with the closing song, with the opening song from Middle School. It's DNC with Cake by the Ocean. See you next week.
Waste time with a masterpiece, to waste time with a masterpiece. You should be wrong with me, you should be wrong with me. You're a real life fantasy, you're a real life fantasy. But you're moving so carefully, let's start living dangerously.